As I already said, my topic is going to be non-Gaussian guarantees for multi-field inflationary models. I've already written all that over here and a few references over there that I will point to during my talk. Now, my main aim here at this talk is twofold. First of all, I would like to give you kind of general introductions to why non-Gaussian guarantees are interesting, why you should care about them, and also why multi-field inflationary models such as assisted inflation or inflation are interesting. Since not everyone in the audience is working actively on cosmology, I'm going to devote quite some time to the introductory chapters, where I'm first going to look at observations in the introduction. What do we know about the structures of the early universe? Then I'm going to tell you how we characterize structure, what are the relevant variables to focus on, and what are the statistical properties we want to extract from that. Specifically, how do we compute correlation functions? Then I switch gears and I talk about inflation. Now we talked yesterday, which talked about inflation, so I'm going to be rather brief here. And I would only like to make the point, what's the main feature of assisted inflation? What differentiates that from single-field inflationary models? After these introductory chapters, I go to the main core of the talk, which will be the non-Gaussianities. And this is work that I've done over the summer with Richard Easter at Yale. And what we did is we extended the existing delta n formalism to multi-field inflationary models where we can have any number of fields, but we constrained ourselves to assisted inflation or inflation. Now, after giving you the formalism, I'm going to look at a few toy models to build up intuition and to get a feeling how large non-Gaussian keys can become. And in the end, I'm going to give a conclusion. The main punchline will be that we do not expect large non-Gaussianities from multi-field inflationary models, which might be a bit surprising because naively one would expect non-Gaussianities to be large since you have many fields, you have many isocurvature modes, and they all can contribute to non-Gaussianities. Okay. Also feel free to interrupt me whenever I'm clear in my handwriting. I don't have the best handwriting, but I restrain from using PowerPoint because it is too tempting to put too much on the slides, so I hope this goes well with the Blackboard talk. But let's get started. Let's have a look at observations and what observations can tell us about the structure of the early universe. Yesterday, Andreas talked about the cosmic microwave background radiation, which is a remnant of the early universe, originating about 380,000 years after the Big Bang. So if you look at the CMBR, you're going to see that there are hot spots and cold spots. And the amplitude of those fluctuations is about 1 to 10 to the 5. Which means if you want to study anything in the early universe, we can use perturbation theory. Even a few hundred thousand years after the Big Bang, the temperature fluctuation, and henceforth fluctuations in the densities of matter, they are very tiny, minuscule. If you go further back in time, these perturbations become even smaller, and you're justified to use perturbation theory. So by looking at the CMBR, you're looking at perturbations, and you're probing the seeds of structure that later on structure turn into galaxies and you and me in the long run. Now, if you want to describe perturbations in a statistical way, what you do, you compute correlation functions from a theoretical point of view, but you can also extract them directly by looking at the data. Let's say for the power spectrum, you look at two-point correlation functions. You look at a spot here and a spot here, you ask, is there a correlation between those spots? What you get out of this is the power spectrum, and if you then compute how the power spectrum depends on the wave number k, you can extract some parameters that go on the name of observable quantities, okay? For example, for the power spectrum, you have the scalar spectral index, which is approximately equal to 1, a little bit smaller, but if you use the recent WMAP3 data set. You could also look at the amplitudes of scalar modes, you could look at amplitudes of tensor modes, and compute the ratio of those two, so the ratio of tensors to scalars, this R, and it's a small quantity. But you don't have to stop at the two-point function in the power spectrum, but you can also go on to computing higher-order correlation functions. let's say, the three-point correlation function, then you would ask, is there a correlation between three points? And similarly, you can extract a quantity, which is called FNL. So it's a nonlinear parameter, and I'm going to give you the explicit definition of that model. And you can go higher, four-point correlation function to tall ML. And at some point, you get bored and stop doing this game. But basically, what you do, you're extracting statistical properties of perturbations. And you can measure all of those. Now, observationally, FNL did not observe a three-point correlation function, which means we have not observed any non-Gaussianity so far. This characterizes here non-Gaussianities. But in the near future, Planck satellite will become online, and we're going to be sensitive, much more sensitive to non-Gaussianity. So there's the hope of seeing something non-trivial in here. And my motivation of looking at non-Gaussianities is exactly the upcoming observations that are going to probe this region. And furthermore, different models of the early universe, say different models of inflation, they should give different predictions for these guys. They all give more or less the same for the power spectrum. Otherwise, that would be a work out to begin with. OK, so this is from an observational point of view. Now, if you are a theorist, what you have to do is you have to, of course, compute all those guys. You always have to start by picking a certain model of the early universe. Now, I'm going to be rather conservative today, and I constrain my interest to inflation. But there is not only one model of inflation. You have single-field inflationary models, hybrid inflation, multi-field models such as assisted inflation, natural inflation. The list goes on. There are hundreds of models. And what you do is you pick your favorite model, you compute correlation functions, and you compute the power spectrum, you compute the B spectrum or the three-point correlation function, and you extract all those quantities from your favorite theoretical model. What I'm going to do is I'm going to take assisted inflation, compute the correlation function, and extract this nonlinear parameter, FNL. The formalism I developed with Richard Easter has recently been extended by Siri and Blitzy to compute the four-point correlation function. They put this paper 2 weeks ago. And I'm sure someone will pick it up and compute the five-point correlation function, and so on. However, I think the most interesting parameter is actually this FNL, because for Gaussian perturbations, this guy vanishes identically. So this is a very sensitive measure of Gaussianities. When you look at even numbered correlation functions, say 2 points or 4 points, you always expect the Gaussian signal. OK, so this was my still rather quick introduction about what do we know from the observational point of view, and what do we have to do from a theoretical point of view. And I'm now going to go ahead and tell you a bit on how we characterize structure. But are there any questions about this end-wave introduction? OK, so let's go ahead. In here, in CNB, we would look at the temperature fluctuations. But this is actually not the most well-suited variable to compute from a theoretical point of view. We are interested in perturbations in the matter sector or metric sector. So what we have to do is we have to construct a variable to describe the structure in the early universe. If you have only one inflaton field, it doesn't really matter what you choose, because there's only one effective degree of freedom, and you can choose whatever you like. You could directly compute the perturbation in the inflaton field, or you work with a metric degree of freedom. However, if you have multi-fields, let's say 100 fields or 1,000 fields, it becomes a little bit cumbersome to do this brute force calculation and computing all modes of all fields. Let's say for each additional inflaton field, you would have to incorporate a new perturbation mode. They will usually go hand in hand with additional isocurvature. But what I would like to do is I would like to argue in favor of the Bardeen-Mukhanov variable. If you use that, there's a very elegant mechanism, a very elegant formalism of incorporating the effect of isocurvature modes onto, let's say, two-point correlation function, three-point correlation function, and so on. So this guy is defined following, so it's called Z. It's a combination of metric degrees of freedoms and meta degrees of freedom, so it's minus the Bardeen potential. This is a perturbation of the metric scalar. And then the sine straight, the Hubble divided by rho plus dot. You can write this down to any order in your perturbation expansion. So this would be order perturbation squared. And I'm lazy, I don't want to write down all of those. In fact, if you're computing the three-point correlation function, you need this guy to second order. Now, you should note that the sign is not universally here. Depending on which author you're talking to, you have a plus or minus sign. But it doesn't really indicate. So you see, you have here a combination of meta degrees of freedom. If you have 100 inflaton fields, well, they will all contribute to delta rho. And you have your metric degree of freedom. Now, what is nice about this guy? First of all, on large scales, you can relate it to the perturbation in the number of e-foldings. So focusing on large scales. This is approximately equal to the perturbation of the number of e-foldings, delta n. Inflation needs about 60 e-foldings, but you know, you have perturbation there, from some initial time to some final time, and of course, it depends on space. Initial time, you can think about the time when the mode crosses the horizon. For the final time, I'm going to take the time when inflation ends, or specifically when my slow roll approximation breaks down, and explore its space. Now, it's not very convenient to work in real space because in real space, you build up correlations over time since gravity is a trap. So if you want to characterize structure and you want to characterize what kind of structure you observe, you're going to better look at the Fourier transform of that. So you get a zeta k, where k is the wave number. And the goal here is to extract statistical properties of this zeta k. Now, before we're going to go ahead and compute the statistical properties, let's make a rough guess for the two-point correlation. Yes,
sorry. Sorry, I don't want to interrupt your phone, but just intuitively, so you're going to have a multi-field model, and it's going to be slow roll. So I'm just trying to intuitively, why do you expect that non-Gaussianity will be larger by having multi-field? Mainly, I would say, sure, you have multi-field, but you still have just one trajectory in field space, and zeta characterizes the adiabatic fluctuation around that trajectory.
That's true, but another. Let's say you look at the adiabatic mode on. Adiabatic modes are frozen once they cross the horizon if you don't have isocurvature modes.
Yeah.
If you have isocurvature modes, even the adiabatic mode evolves after it crosses the horizon.
Correct.
Now, if you have multiple fields, let's say you have 100 fields, you have one adiabatic mode and 99 isocurvature modes.
Yes.
And they all contribute to the evolution outside of the horizon. And this evolution outside of the horizon is at the core of the origin of non-Gaussianities. And in fact,
so that I can understand. You say basically you also have isocurvature perturbations.
Exactly.
But then you have to somehow find a mechanism by which this isocurvature perturbations contribute mostly to the three-point function.
Exactly. And this is exactly what I'm going to extract. I'm going to extract specifically the contribution that is due to isocurvature modes. That, or another way of saying it, I'm going to extract the contribution that is due to the evolution outside of the horizon. Now, if you have very good intuition, you might at this point say, well, as long as you do slow roll, this should be small. And this is in fact true. This is what we find. Because you only see the isocurvature modes if you have a sharp turn in the field trajectory. And if you use slow roll approximation, you don't have really sharp turns, you only have a bit of isocurvature modes. And this is at the core of why you don't observe large non-Gaussianities as long as the slow roll approximation is valid. But I'm jumping ahead here, I'm already in my conclusion. So let me continue telling you how to first of all compute the non-Gaussianities, and then I'm going to explain again how isocurvature modes contribute to the non-Gaussianities. At this point, you might actually wonder, if I'm only focusing on this one variable, how the heck will I be able to incorporate the isocurvature modes? Now, it is basically this relation in here. The number of e-foldings knows about the evolution of all the fields. It's an integrated quantity, integrated power. And that's at the core why it is possible in this delta n formalism to incorporate the effect of all isocurvature modes without having to integrate 99 isocurvature modes if you have 100 fields. So that's another advantage of using the specific variable. Okay, so what would you expect naively to get from, let's say, a single field inflationary model for that? So I would like to give an heuristic argument. Don't see this as a relation. First of all, very early on, I don't know much about the universe. Let's say those guys are uncorrelated. You don't have correlation with the division of inflation. Now, as long as linear perturbation theory is valid, each mode will more or less evolve independently, and they stay more or less uncorrelated, I would say. Now, whenever you have a bunch of uncorrelated variables, the central limit theorem of statistical mechanics tells you that the probability distribution for these guys is a Gaussian. Nothing fancy. You should learn this in statistics 101. What does it mean for correlation functions? Well, it means that all information is in the two-point correlation function or in the power spectrum. The higher order correlation functions, if you have an even number of correlation functions, can be written as products of two-point correlation functions. Odd-numbered correlation functions will vanish. Hence, the naive guess would be for probability distribution for this guy should be a Gaussian. All the information is in the two-point correlation function, and specifically this parameter FNL should be. Now, this is not entirely true. Even for single field inflationary models, you do get non-Gaussian entities. So let's go ahead and compute those guys. Now, I'm going to assume that you all have seen a correlation function. If you haven't, come to me after my talk, and I'm going to take 10 minutes to explain what a correlation function is. So what I have to do now is to tell you how do we parameterize correlation functions. Let's say two-point correlation function, zeta k1 and zeta k2. This will be, I'm dropping factors of 2 pi because there's no chance I'm going to keep them straight to the talk. So this will be proportional to the delta function of the sum over ki. And then whatever you get, you call the power spectrum. So this p of zeta, depending on k, divided by k to the 3 for historical reasons. So you compute the two-point function, you extract the power spectrum. Once you have the power spectrum, you compute the logarithmic derivative of that, and you get the scalar spectral index. If your fluctuations are actually Gaussian, then this combination here is nothing else than the variance of your Gaussian distribution. But we don't want to stop at the two-point correlation function. We want to compute higher-order correlation functions. So let's look at the three-point function, k1, k2, and k3. Again, you're going to get the delta function of the sum over the ki's. This means that the three momenta have to build a triangle, something like this. And for only two momenta, well, you have not really a triangle, you have two momenta up, momenta down. That's the reason why the power spectrum only depends on the magnitude of the wave number k. If you look at the three-point correlation function, you should expect a dependence on, let's say, the area of this triangle. And this is in fact true, and we will be able to extract this quantity, but I don't want to focus on that because it's all understood. Now, what's left here, you call the B spectrum of zeta, and it depends on k1, k2, and k3. And let's see. Yes. So now that we know what the B spectrum is and what the power spectrum is, I can tell you what the definition is for my nonlinear parameter FNL that I'm going to focus on. This FNL. it's nothing else than the ratio of the B spectrum divided by the power spectrum squared. And there are some factors of K up front. Next proportional sign here. It's the product over the KIs to the 3 divided by the sum over the KI to the 3. And factors of 2 pi thrown in for good measure. Now, at this point, you can immediately realize if the 3-point correlation function vanishes, the B spectrum vanishes. If the B spectrum vanishes, this FNL will vanish. So this is a very, the first very sensitive parameter to non-Gaussianities. This vanishes for Gaussian perturbations. If you compute the 2-point correlation function, you also get contributions from non-Gaussianities, but it is overshadowed from the signal that you get from Gaussian perturbations. So what are the observational ranges for this parameter here? If you look at the WMAP3 data, you get that FNL has to be smaller than 114 and bigger than 54. I got this from the WMAP3 data article on the web. I'm sure there are now already better estimates for this guy. Now, in the near future, say Planck satellites, they will probe this nonlinear parameter up to magnitudes of order 1. So FNL of about 1 will be detectable. If you want to go below 1, it becomes rather challenging because you run into the cosmic Brian's limit.
If you could just explain it briefly, the V depends on three values of K,
yes.
And the P value depends on K. So how do you get one number out of that? I mean, do you sum
up? You have to choose basically what the momentum triangle is. I haven't looked carefully at the observational papers. I know how I characterize it from a theoretical point of view. I will get a parameter which depends on the shape of the triangle. If you're interested at observational, they do it. There's a paper by Bartolo, Materese, and Ferrato from 2004, which gives a nice review of all these things. But I don't know from the top of my head. Okay.
Say just single field, there is an argument that this FNL or whatever the 3-point over 2-point would peak for the very thin triangle. Is that true? There's always this argument that you can either focus on equilateral
So let's say we look at single field inflationary models. There, if you compute what FNL is, you get its some factor up front, I think it's over 5. Then you have the scalar spectral index plus a parameter f, which characterizes the momentum triangle. So, actually, I have it written out somewhere. Okay, so minus sign, this is not 6 over 5, but 5 over 12, whatever. And here I have a tensor spectral index. So this guy f is 0 if you have such a triangle, and it is 5 over 6 if you have an equilateral triangle. So it depends really what kind of triangle you choose, but this is actually not the major contribution to that, because the tensor spectral index is close to 0. This you can find this in the paper by Malasena from 2002. Okay. I my notes.
So you're saying that Planck will have a chart at single field?
Well,
the slow roll?
Not really. This will be of order 1, and this is actually, this is optimistic here. Mm-hmm. So single field inflation, you won't really detect it. Now, what I'm going to show later on is that for multi-field inflation, a multi-additional contribution will be even smaller than 1. So you cannot discriminate between multi-field and single field if you're only looking at Planck. I've seen in the literature one claim that at some point you're going to be able to detect even 0.01, then you could clearly discriminate between the two, but I don't know how much of that is wishful thinking. So, I would say order one, that's reachable. I think below that, it's a bit fishy. Now, at this point, I should also mention that there are also other sources of non-Gaussian entities. Specifically, during heat reheating, the inflaton fields evolve very rapidly. So this will be a major source of non-Gaussianity that can also overshadow all of those signals. I'm not going to focus on those, but if you're interested in non-Gaussianities from reheating, there was a recent paper by Jim Klein, one of his students, came out 2 weeks ago. OK, now we know how to characterize structure, specifically what's the definition of this nonlinear parameter. So what I have to do now is to tell you a bit about multi-field inflation, and then you're going to go ahead and compute this guy from a specific multi-field inflationary model. Inflation, I think it's 3. So the first thing I'm going to do, I'm going to restrain myself to a potential, which is the sum of individual potentials, Vi, depending on the inflaton fields. But there is no cross-coupling between the fields. I runs from 1 to some curly n, where curly n is the number of fields. This might seem like a very harsh assumption at the beginning. And it's true. It simplifies matters quite a bit. But you should be aware that there are actually models of the early universe from string theory which predict such potentials. Specifically, if you look at the axions that you have in string theory, the hundreds of axions, if they're close to their minimum, the cross-couplings between the axion fields is suppressed, and you get exactly a potential that looks like that. So this is calls on the name of inflation, and it's a specific realization of assisted inflation. But I'm not going to talk about inflation from string theory point of view. I'd simply take it as some phenomenological model at this point. Simply go with me.
Is that in coordinates where the target space metric is flat?
Yes, I'm using standard canonical kinetic terms, nothing fancy in here. If you're interested, what happens if you allow for non-canonical kinetic terms, so let's say target space metric, it's not flat. There was a recent paper by Kashrou and collaborators which made a very extensive examination of non-Gaussianities from single field models where you do more with the kinetic terms. So there's also an additional source of non-Gaussianity if you have fancy kinetic terms.
They were thinking fancy in the sense of functions of derivatives. But if you just have a metric in front of two derivatives.
Yes, I work with really the standard kinetic terms here. What they're looking at, they're parameterizing, Kashrou and collaborators parameterizing the kinetic term by having some general function in front of it. So and then they examine what, for a given function, what are the non-Gaussianities. And if you tune this guy, you can actually get also large contributions. But here it's really the straightforward inflaton fields that you find in textbooks. Now, the next simplifying assumption that I'm going to make is I'm going to use slow roll inflation. So everything you see from here on will be true during slow roll. And during slow roll, the Klein-Gordon equation is very simple. 3h pi dot, 9, is minus the derivative of the potential with respect to the mass field. And you have the Einstein equation, 3h squared, is equal to W. Now, a word regarding units. I said reduced Planck mass equals to 1, therefore you don't see any Newton's constant flying around here. I'm lazy. OK. Now, if you want to get inflation from the system, you can get inflation if the slow roll parameters are small. So roll parameters. And focusing on two sets, epsilon I, defined as the derivative of the I's potential squared divided by W, 1/2 up front. And there are also eta I's, which are the second derivatives divided by W, and 2 primes. And what we want is that these guys are small compared to 1. If they are small compared to 1, you can get inflation. Now, What is so nice about assisted inflation? Let's say you only have a single field and you compute how much this field has to move in order to give you 60 orders of feed foldings, you will realize that the initial field values have to be larger than the plant mass. So the field has to traverse a region in its configuration space that goes over super Planckian scales. And this might be troublesome if you have some background in field theory, because you actually don't expect your gravitational action to be valid anymore. Now, you can alleviate this problem if you use multiple fields that all contribute to inflation. And let me show you how this works with a very simple toy model. So I'm going to keep that. I'm not going to keep the definition here. Okay, let's look at the number of e-foldings. This is nothing else than the integral of the Hubble from star to C. Now, if you're working during slow roll, you can replace the Hubble by the potentials, and you get minus the integral from star to C of B over B prime, and there is a sum of I in front, the integral over B prime. Now, this was first done by Starobinsky a while back, but it's actually a tool I have to show, so it's very straightforward. Now, if you know the potential, let's say we take Vi to be 1/2 m squared I x squared, and I'm going to assume that all the masses are the same for the sake of argument. Then you can go ahead and compute this guy. And what you get is that this is basically the number of fields divided by 4 minus the initial field value pi I star squared minus pi I c squared. And this guy is actually very small compared to pi I star squared. So you can forget about this term. And you get that the initial field value has to be, what's the number? So if you take 60 number of e-foldings, you get roughly 240 divided by the number of fields. So if the number of fields is 1, this tells you that the initial field value is larger than the Planck mass, which is troublesome. But if you have of the order of maybe 500 fields, such as the bundle of axioms from string theory, then the initial field values don't have to be super Planckian. They can all be sub-Planckian, and that's nice. So this is a motivation as to why one should be interested in these type of inflationary models. And there are other reasons too. But I'm not at this point. Yes?
But the condition for slow roll inflation, what are
the conditions? Are that this guy is small compared to 1.
Each epsilon I.
Each epsilon I, and also the sum over epsilon I has to be small compared to 1. So I'm going to assume all of those.
Okay, so yeah, there is a limit, I mean, because there are no fields. If each field is very close to zero and the number of fields increases, that sum is going to be big, right?
Well, you can, even if you have a bunch of, you can actually show that the heaviest field will leave the world first. So actually, a general feature of assisted inflation, when you have a very broad spectrum, is that heavy fields will leave the world very early on, and the Rolle approximation is not valid for this field anymore. But since you don't have any cross couplings, it will not take all the other fields down too, but the other fields will continue giving you inflation. But of course, you should get rid of this heavy field early on. Now, this should only be an instructive example as to why assisted inflation is interesting. You can do it for a mass spectrum. So actually, from string theory, the spectrum for masses will be the Marshenko-Pastua law. That was a paper by Richard Easter and Ian McAllister, who computed the spectrum by means of random matrix theory. But you can also use exponential potentials. It always works more or less the same. assisted inflation itself goes back to actually Anupam Mazumdar and collaborators, which figured out this effect first, I think, 7 years ago. Now we can go ahead and compute number Gaussianities. And I will not drag you through the computation, but I'm going to jump into the computation at the point where Vernizian wants basically left to general treatment and focused on two-field models from that. So this already makes use of a series of papers that extended the delta n formulas. The expression you get for the nonlinear parameter looks as follows. And now I'm going to write an equal sign, so I have to keep vector straight. So this is the ratio of tensor to scalar modes divided by 16, it's a small quantity, times 1 plus f, where f characterizes the momentum triangle. Remember, this f is equals to 0 if you have such a triangle, and it is 5 over 6 if you have an equilateral triangle, plus a contribution which does not depend on the momenta anymore, sum over I of the derivative of the number of e-foldings with respect to I, derivative of the number of e-foldings with respect to the j's field, times the second derivative, divided by sum over, and I think that's the square. Yep. And by this shorthand notation, I mean n comma I is defined as the derivative of the number of e-foldings with respect to the I's field at the beginning of inflation. Now, this first term is already small compared to 1, or order 1. But the second term, we still have to evaluate. What Vernizian once did, they focused only on two fields and computed that. Richard and I took this expression and computed for general multi-field models, general in the sense that we allow for any type of potential in here, but we do assume that the potential is the sum of individual potentials that don't cross come. And it's not clear, like simply staring at this, if this is large or small.
Sorry, so the one field case, then the second term would be the term that you had with NS?
Well, you can rewrite it then in such that you recover the result of Marx.
Just a matter, because the multi-weighted basic or multi-weighted set, these potentials are not unreasonable, for instance, in X and field models. Don't those overproduce the axiom abundance?
What do you mean?
They have to calculate it because the coupling strength is much too large in these cases, isn't it?
Well, if your axiom fields are close to their minimum, the cross coupling vanishes identically. You have shifts in the trees which suppress these cross couplings.
And the abundance of the axioms is okay to calculate?
It is, well, it is okay, I think.
Really?
In this model, don't they have non-minimal don't they have curved target space metrics? That's why I was asking the earlier question.
Yeah.
Okay, well, we can talk about inflation maybe after the talk in more detail. It would take me a bit longer. But basically, what you do is you the axiom field, these fields are not identical to the axiom fields. You make a field redefinition, and you do this only after you expand it around the minimum. So initially, it's a whole mess because the axiom potential is actually a cosine, there's a tilde in there, and they all are coupled. So if you're not close to the minimum, it's a horrible mess. But if you're close to the minimum, you can expand everything, and you can show that it is exactly such a potential without cross coupling. This was done in the paper by Easton and McAllister. And it's by no means not trivial, so it would warrant all.
This only if you use a quadratic. And then it sounds like what they're doing is they're going to normal coordinates to make the metric locally flat.
Yes, exactly.
Expanded potential around the minimum.
Exactly.
And they dogmatize the mass term.
Yes. So this is exactly what they're doing. And you can then compute what the spectrum of those the masses is.
But then you wouldn't expect it to generalize to things like exponentials. It would be specific for quadratic functions.
Well, sure. Inflation only has quadratic potentials. But I don't want to talk only about inflation, but I keep it general at this point. I don't have to specify what these potentials are in order to rewrite the second term in terms of the slow roll parameters. And this will be actually enough to argue that this contribution is small. So I don't need to actually know what the...
Sorry, if I'm saying just a little, I mean, in those models, what would be the pressure coherence scale? Roughly. I mean,
because
it's,
I don't know
it's like always too low, actually.
I don't know it from the top of my head. You should go over this out. Great. I think I have to speed up a bit. Good. I'm going to call this second term here FNL4, because previously these two terms were actually three terms, that were four. It's only a name. Now, what you can do now is you make use of the separability of the potential. You use the definition of the Savoy parameters. You also use that as long as you have the roll inflation, there are n minus 1 integrals of motion. You use the Einstein equation. You do quite a bit of algebra. And in the end, you get an expression for this second term, which is solely in terms of the potential and the roll parameters. And I'm going to avoid, again, showing you the derivation of that. If you're interested in that, you can go over this after the talk. It's in my case with Richard. But the final answer is kind of neat. So let me write this down and erase something. What do we get? This nonlinear parameter is given by a contribution, the first one, which is this kind of obvious that it is of order of the world parameter epsilon.
Yeah, sorry, can I? Yes. Maybe it's a stupid question, but it seems that if I rotate in field space to mm-hmm. the field line, that the field or whatever, right, then the answer would reduce to single field.
Well,
it only depends on the derivatives of number of e-folds with respect to the trajectory.
Sure, if you focus only on adiabatic modes, the contribution due to, let's say, the evolution outside of the horizon matters, because you're only looking at adiabatic modes. But specifically for n squared pi squared potentials, you actually don't have an attractor in there. So you do have always isocurvature modes.
Yeah, I guess I'm not seeing where the isocurvature contribution is in your second term. It seems
you don't, it's hidden in N. If you remember how N number of e-folding is defined, it integrates over all the fields. And it's not only focusing on, let's say, the field trajectory. It's not only the adiabatic mode in there. It's sensitive to the evolution of all the fields.
So
I'm going to come to this in a second.
Yeah, it's,
yep. It's good, but it's not obvious. Because it wasn't obvious to me either. So now, so the first term, we need to see it's a four epsilon. Don't want to bother writing it down. But the second term is not immediately a roll, so press it down. This is the sum over k and l of some uk, ul, these are guys of order 1, divided by epsilon k star, epsilon l star. And then you have the matrix AKL divided by sum over K of UK over epsilon K star square. This star means you evaluate at the beginning of inflation. Now, if you only count the epsilon series of epsilon squared cancels out, and you have these guys which are of order 1, the matrix elements are actually kind of small, but you're summing over all of them. So you could, if you only stare at this, it's not naively clear how large the contribution is. Of course, I have to tell you now what is UK and what is UL. And at this point, it would be nice to have a PowerPoint. But I use a low-tech version of PowerPoint, so this is UK, this is AKL. And you see you can, UK is basically the difference between the potential at the beginning of inflation, at the end of inflation, and then there's a term which depends on several parameters. AKL looks a bit messy, but it's actually a very symmetric matrix. And it has some nice properties. For example, if you sum over a line or over a row, this matrix vanishes. So the contribution of this vanishes. Now what I have to do is to look at this expression for a few different cases. Now I cannot, memorize this. Let's have a look at this guy for different cases. Let's say we look at adiabatic modes only. So this was your point, what happens if you have adiabatic modes. If you have adiabatic modes, you can recover this result if you let Tc go towards T star. Because for adiabatic modes, you don't have evolution outside of the horizon. It's a single field adiabatic modes. And then, you look for this UK. Well, this term cancels out. This term cancels out. You get epsilon k star over epsilon star. You plug it in here, epsilon k star cancels out. This whole term becomes independent of the indices. You can take it out of the sum. So you end up with a sum over k and l of akl, meaning you're summing over lines and rows of this matrix. And now you look how this guy is defined. If you sum over epsilon l, you actually get epsilon. Epsilon over epsilon is your 1. Also, you have a sum over j in here. So this guy vanishes. Meaning, long story short, in this limit, the whole second term is identical to 0. And let's call this guy f. F equals to 0. And you might say that this corresponds to the adiabatic limit. Sometimes it's also called the horizon Poisson approximation. It's a bit fishy, the way how you call it. But. So that was easy. Now let's look at a few other cases, what the magnitude of this guy is here. So you've already seen, if you've only adiabatic modes, this vanishes. And this is nice, because it shows you that this term f is solely due to the evolution outside of the horizon, which is what I was interested in to begin with. I wanted to know what is the effect of isocurvature modes. Isocurvature modes source an evolution outside of the horizon, and this evolution outside of the horizon will give you a non-zero term here. Of course, the first term is also has also contributions, but it's always vortex. So let's look at a few specific toy models, what this F is.
One thing that's kind of a, just get some intuition for this, that if m squared is large and positive, it seems like that's the direction along which you're not going to roll, because then you're at the bottom of the problem. And so then that field should drop out of the whole problem, it seems.
Yes, heavy fields. Basically drop off the problem.
But in your formula, the only place, so the second derivatives are appearing only through A, and that was just
yes.
Eta and the thing that's behind the board there. And it's hard to see, so the, if I had Eta being large and positive, then it's...
Well,
can you see
first of all, it cannot be larger than 1, right? So there's still no curve. But you're right, the field with the largest mass will have the largest Eta. And
the Norman's small roll condition is you only want the negative betas to be small. The positive betas can be as big as you like, because that's just something which is a decimal direction you don't roll. And if you're in a trough, then you love having positive, as long as somebody's negative. So
in the writing that I had also to assume that the positive betas are small. So I should have actually said that eta I is small compared to 1. This was one assumption that I had to make in order to get to this point. Which is not necessarily that. So to put it another way, if, let's say, a field has to have large mass, you will get a large eta at some point. Shortly thereafter, it will actually terminate the roll and it will roll down to its minimum and settle there.
But that doesn't mean that snow roll ends, it just means that snow roll doesn't go in that direction.
Exactly. So you have to get rid of this field. The other fields are still slow rolling.
Yeah.
So a better way of saying what should the sum be over here, this should be the fields that are actively contributing to the world. If you have one field hanging around which has a very large mass, it will drop out of the world, don't contribute to inflation, but the other fields still contribute.
Well, we can't take that limit with this formula, you're saying.
Well, now there is a point where this formula doesn't develop anymore, where fields rapidly well, basically stops your rolling. And what I would argue in favor for is to simply get rid of this field within the sum. But this is a bit fishy argument. What should actually check this numerically? This is one of the follow-ups that we're actually working on to go beyond this labeled approximation, specifically to go beyond this very stringent assumption you have to make here. So that point. Okay. Now, okay, 5 minutes, so I think I can get to the time while it's in 5 minutes.
Yeah, you have a couple of more minutes than that.
Yes?
We started a few
minutes. Okay.
And that's that talks a few minutes fast.
Well, I might actually finish early. Good. So, cube toy models. So, let's first look at a very easy case. What happens if you have. Well, now I'm going to focus on Emster phi square potentials. But we also look at other potentials. We can use that plug in there to compute what that analysis. So, let's first. Look at MI, are all the same. What happens in this case? Well, I would expect if all the masses are the same, and we also give them the same initial conditions of all the fields, that we get an effective one field model which recaptures everything. So we would expect that this contribution matters, and indeed it does. F is identical to zero. So that's nice. The formula doesn't screw up. We didn't screw up in doing the algebra here. Now, let's do something more interesting. Let's take two fields and let's say in two squared, this equals twice M1 squared. If you choose that, you don't have to make any other approximations. You can compute analytically what FNL is. Let's see what this F is. And so it's minus 9 over 16. Divided by the number of efoldings to the fourth power. This coincides with the result that Bernitzian once finds. So again, our formula actually reduces to their expression. And you should note that this is heavily still road suppressed. Usually, an epsilon parameter is of order 1 over n. So this goes like epsilon to the fourth power. It's minuscule. You can forget about that. Next thing, well, we still look at two fields, but let's allow for some other parameter 2 here, some alpha and 1 squared. What you get is that this F is proportional to 1 over n to the 2 alpha. You can, in each case, you can compute the prefactor. One thing I have not mentioned so far is if you have these kind of potentials, you don't actually have an attractive solution, which means you're sensitive to initial conditions in some sense, which will also show up in this prefactor. But the initial conditions don't change the suppression. Now, what do these cases tell you? Well, first of all, the best thing you can get would be alpha equals 1. Then you would have 1 over n squared. And this would still be a suppression of epsilon squared. So it's still smaller than the contribution you had already up front. But if you let alpha go to 1, of course you're recovering this case, so it should match identically. So the next thing we looked at, what happens if we allow for a general spectrum? But we're going to assume that the spectrum is narrow. We focus on a narrow spectrum because we expect actually the largest possible F for a narrow spectrum, exactly because of this contribution. Now, what do I mean by a narrow spectrum? So let's say M1 squared over MI squared. I order the masses according to how large they are. A larger I is corresponds to a larger mass. And this will be parameterized as 1 minus delta I, where all the delta I's are assumed to be small compared to 1. This way, I guarantee that I have a narrow spectrum. And if you compute that, you get that F is proportional to basically delta squared. This is the sum of the delta i's divided by the number of fields divided by n squared, where n is the number of e-foldings again. So again, it goes along with this expression we got for two fields. So this guy is of order epsilon squared. And it also goes to zero if all the masses have the same value, because delta is then identical to zero. So we also recover the specific case.
Sorry, so this is so, but so by assumption, you're not allowing large hierarchies between your masses because then you would say I can integrate.
We only did this for simplicity. You can actually, another case that I'm looking at right now is the specific Marchenko-Pastour law that Richard Easton and McAllister found, which is not a narrow spectrum. So you can have a very broad spectrum. Then you actually have to specify what the spectrum is. Here I could keep these delta as general. I didn't have to know anything about them except they are small. But if you give me a specific mass spectrum, I can compute this expression for that.
So you did this in I'm just looking really at C, and suppose that both M1 and 2 are small, so that you have solo, but they have but alpha is tiny.
Mm-hmm.
Am I allowed to have
that? You're allowed to have that. Of course, if you have small masses, you this will crop into the initial conditions for the fields.
Okay.
But in the end, what matters is actually the ratio of the masses for this contribution. Now it crops in. You might say it crops in the initial conditions which give you the prefect. But the prefect is always a one on one, except if you jump to really groups and you want to get something larger, you have by choosing really unreasonable initial conditions. By unreasonable, I mean initial conditions that are not equal energy initial conditions or equal field initial conditions. If our one field is really huge compared to the other fields, then you might tweak around with the prefect. But it doesn't change the surface expression. So that's actually the main point. I'm not really interested in the prefactor here. I'm interested in the suppression due to the number of e-folds. And you can immediately see the best thing you can get is all of epsilon squared, which is small.
Well,
I ordered the masses such that, sorry, I should mention this alpha table.
That's what I
ordered the masses. I ordered the masses at the beginning.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
That is
you say I'm too much
to exactly. You can always reorder all your fields such that. Sorry. I start using the next visit. So, I don't like to stop. Am I bigger than J? If not, bigger J.
And this might be the same question, but in the case D, if I compare D to C, mm-hmm. is it 1 over n squared or 1 over n to 2 over 1 minus delta?
There is 1 minus delta, but I expanded here everything in terms of delta.
So, many delta
so this, exactly, you get actually this contribution looks a bit more messy.
Huh.
So I pulled your leg.
Part of n really is changing.
Yes, it is changing. But since this guy is small, you're allowed to expand it in terms of delta. And unfortunately, the leading order contribution is delta squared, which means you have to keep throughout all terms up to delta squared, and it takes 100 pages to do that.
Even in single field, you would have such order epsilon squared correction to the three-point function, which you
well for single field
advantage in your case.
Well, remember, we still have. Terms in here, the leading order contribution is here for order epsilon,
sure.
But it also depends on some other stuff. So we'll get order epsilon plus order epsilon squared.
Yeah,
so there are still terms in here.
Yeah.
Yes. But the main point is that this term, which is not naively so Sorolle suppressed, is actually more heavily so Sorolle suppressed
right.
than the term we already know about very well. And also these terms are small compared to. I think I erased them. For the general expression of FNL, I did not only have FNL4, but there were other contributions which were affordable. So these terms are still there, and this is only a slight change to this contribution, which you also get for single field inflation. Now, what's the punchline? If you have hopes of finding or discriminating between multi-field inflationary models by looking at non-Gaussianities, you should be dissatisfied. You don't get large non-Gaussianities from multi-field inflationary models, at least if they have a separable potential. Now, this is good in the sense that assisted inflation is not ruled out. This is nice, because these models would have already been ruled out, if not. And it's bad in the sense that you can't actually test it. Such a model exists in the early universe. Now, immediately, what you can do now is you can also use this formalism to compute the contribution for any mass vector that you like. So, and you can also use other potentials. So it's a very useful formalism to also incorporating all the effects of isocurvature modes. Let me remind you, if you were to do a brute force computation by integrating and computing all isocurvature modes and then trying to compute the number of subtleties, if you have an order of 1,000 fields, you have to compute 999 fields of curvature modes. And this would be quite cumbersome. Here, on the other hand, you have a very elegant formalism of doing it. Now.
Sorry.
Yes.
Can I directly translate bound on isocurvature modes to bound on FNL? Wouldn't that be a way to kind of rule of thumb to see what's the maximum FNL I would expect?
Yes, you can do something like that. Actually, let's do it here. The first contribution we had in here, this is actually also there if you have adiabatic modes.
Right.
Now, I claimed that this contribution would be due to isocurvature modes. So why do we expect order epsilon squared? Now, if you want to source an isocurvature mode, you have to have a curved field trajectory. So let's say I have two inflaton fields, phi 1 and phi 2. And I have a straight line, you don't source any isocurvature modes. But if you have curved line, you're going to source isocurvature modes. Now, as long as you're doing still role inflation, this curvature is small. What's the order of this curvature? Well, it should be of order epsilon, since it's the only small parameter in the problem. So the presence of isocurvature modes should be suppressed by order epsilon. Now, since this effect is an additional effect due to isocurvature modes, you would expect order epsilon times the effect we have due to adiabatic modes, order epsilon, so that should be order epsilon squared. So hand-wavily, I can say yes, it makes sense. It's a little bit more difficult to track down the specific effect of isocurvature modes. We're trying to do that at the moment by doing a numerical study with one of Rich's postdocs. He wrote a very nice numerical code to compute isocurvature modes, but so far we're only having control over two fields. It's computationally intensive. So what we want to do is actually to extend this code to have 1,000 fields and track all isocurvature modes and then explicitly show how this corresponds to these estimates that we had here analytically. And then you can also go beyond the slow roll approximation.
Yeah, of course.
So this is a nice test for the numerical codes we're developing.
Well, thank you. I think my question is even more native. So if I just rotate any of the permutations, and then I can't have an isocurvature. Okay.
I mean,
remember
the adiabatic perturbation is the perturbation along the trajectory and isocurvature ones,
right,
perpendicular to it. Sure, if you're only focusing on those, this guy's.
Maybe we should hold more questions until after the talk.
Okay.
So I want to just let you
conclude. Okay.
I'm in the chair.
So there are a lot of follow-up projects one can do right now. You can extend this formalism to higher order correlation functions. This has already been partly done by Litzy and Seary, who did it for the four-point correlation function. The main drawback of this formalism is you need slow roll. Specifically, you need that all slow roll parameters are small. What we really want in this is an inflation is a formalism that doesn't make this approximation, but then you have to do numerics. So we're developing a numerical package to do exactly that, and we're going to use these analytical estimates to test our numerical code. So in that sense, it's also very useful to have some analytic control, even though it is not the most general one, because we are constrained to the role. And I'm going over time, so I'm going to conclude here. If you have other questions, I'm going to be around the whole week, so stop me and ask me. Thank you.
Well, I guess since we have a lot of questions during the talk, it's coffee time, so we can all go. And I, for one, really need coffee, so you're there. not